Today, of mice and men, or, well, one particular man at least. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. This past week, in the course of an interesting conversation, I was asked a particularly interesting question, which was essentially this. Why are so many individuals, factions, parties, even countries apparently so willing to either believe what the Kremlin says or actually align themselves in one way or another with the Kremlin's cause? I mean, after all, it's a perfectly fair question. I mean, we have a country, well, a leadership, which has clearly thrown itself into a vicious imperial war in Ukraine, has carried out what surely can only be considered to be a huge array of war crimes, at the same time is propagating obvious falsehoods and trying to encourage essentially a very zero-sum, conspiratorial, paranoid worldview in which, as part of that, it hollows out a whole series of global institutions, which may well not be ideal, but nonetheless do perform a valuable service in terms of maintaining the peace and maintaining a general degree of, for want of a better word, decorum in the world. In those circumstances, why should anyone give Putin's Kremlin the time of day? And I think this is actually a really important question that's worth dwelling on a little, particularly because I do fear that too often we're in the situation of admiring the problem, saying, isn't it worrisome? Isn't it a difficult concern for us, the fact that too many people take the Kremlin's propaganda at face value, or even if they don't, are still willing cynically to work with it? And so I think by breaking this down slightly, by looking a little bit more carefully at why this happens, this also might give us some better clues as to quite what we can do about it. And for me, I think the best way of really trying to get a handle on this is actually to take a leaf out of the spies book. There is this classic acronym to explain how and why people get recruited to be assets. And it comes down to MICE. M-I-C-E. Money, ideology, compromise, ego. I mean, there you go. All of human life is there, surely. But this also, I think, works quite well as a way of explaining how Putin's Russia can actually find its allies and its adherents abroad. Individuals, factions and countries, as I said. So let me just kind of run through these and give a sense of quite how I think this works, because it's not often quite as straightforward as one might think. Now, that having said that, probably the more straightforward one is indeed money. I mean, obviously, there is a whole question of outright bribery. We particularly, for example, have recently had the story break originally from the Czech Republic and Poland about this media channel, The Voice of Europe, which was actually being used as, we are told, a way of funneling money which had been provided by Viktor Medvedchuk, the Ukrainian oligarch now in Russia, close to Putin, probably one of the key figures encouraging him in his initial invasion of Ukraine. But anyway, apparently he sort of put up the money, and it's been handed to various European politicians, either actually physically as cash in meetings in Prague or through cryptocurrency. And okay, I mean, this clearly happens, and this clearly is concerning. Though it's interesting, I mean, we're told it was millions of Czech crowns, which actually, if one converts it across, I mean, that's tens of thousands of pounds. Tens of thousands of pounds. This is often one of the striking things, actually. How cheap people can be. Now, in part, that's because one of the limitations of bribery is often that actually you don't buy people, you rent them. and therefore they will expect continued supplies, but also because actually often bribery is, I would say, only part of the equation. That in fact, there are other reasons why people are, shall we say, predisposed to accept your money. The money is just the icing on the cake. But still, you know, we have this claim of various politicians being bought, and you know, I'm sure that's the case. Now again, whether that just simply means outright buying, no, I think it's unlikely. It's probably more that it means that you are more likely to get them to speak in certain ways, talk about certain talking points, and vote in particular ways at crucial moments. But individual MPs, I mean, except in some very, very specific circumstances, one has to ask whether they're MPs, or we're hearing from Belgium, there's also concerns about MEPs. Actually, does an individual or two or even five individuals often really matter that much? Far more useful is when you can actually buy whole political factions. I mean, this was clearly one of the assumptions when back in 2014... French nationalist right-wing politician Le Pen's party took out a €6 million loan from the so-called first Czech Russian bank. I should stress, though, despite the name, it has absolutely nothing with the Czech Republic. It was a Russian-based bank. Anyway, so they took out this money, which helped them obviously in their campaigning efforts, but also became, once it was publicly known, a considerable embarrassment, quite an albatross around their neck. And it's worth noting that they actually paid it off early in 2023. So yes, you can try and buy people, but you know, in practice, as I say, it's often very hard to see if that really means that they are body and soul your adherents, or whether it just simply means that you can influence them at crucial moments, especially if you're willing to continue paying them. In some ways, I think that rather than individual corruption, which obviously is entirely wrong and should be rooted out and so forth, but the real threat is what we might think of as strategic corruption at the state level. And here, yes, of course, that sometimes can mean bribing national leaders. You know, so much better if you can actually bribe a president for life than an MP for the next 4 years or something. But not just that, it also actually operates on a state level. Are you going to be offering them cheap energy? Are you going to be offering them aid? I mean, for example, you know, those hand-me-down Russian jets that were provided to Serbia, you know, was that purely out of the kindness of Moscow's heart for a Slavic Orthodox brother nation? Or was there the expectation that, in fact, the Serbian leadership is worth cultivating, Serbia is worth cultivating? And therefore, you know, some older jets, and let's be honest, this was before the February 2022 invasion. I think these days, any older kit is simply being refurbished and being thrown into battle. But anyway, some jets seem to be an easy way of buying favour. Just as, for example, we could also go back to the whole era of COVID, when the Russians made a big deal of providing all sorts of medical aid and such like, not just to obvious candidates, but, for example, we saw to Italy, where there was a very, very high-profile sort of initiative, which may well have done very little to actually address the epidemic, but nonetheless led to a lot of very positive media coverage of Russian ambulances, Russian doctors in COVID-hit Italy. So there are all kinds of ways in which you could, again, if not buy a country, but nonetheless use your resources in a way that will actually sort of hopefully garner some kind of immediate political outcome, whether it's in terms of inclining a population towards you, or whether it's essentially offering something to a national leadership as part of a very cynical transactional deal. And frankly, I think we ought to see the operations of the Wagner mercenary group, now kind of rolled into the unfortunately named Africa Corps, in this kind of context. Remember, one of the great virtues of Wagner was not just simply the quality or lack thereof of its trigger pullers, but the fact that actually you could pay it, I won't say in installments, but through providing concessions to diamond mines, gold mines, or whatever else. And in return, there would also usually be what we could think of as a finder's fee for the politicians concerned. So on the one hand, on a government level, you get a security asset that you want and which you don't have to pay with upfront money. And for the individual politicians involved in that scheme, they can also expect some kind of a payoff themselves. So look, money clearly buys you friends. Or at least it rents you people who are willing to look like your friends. And that's fine, though. But the point is, Russia doesn't have that much money. I mean, it's fine, 10,000 euros here, 20,000 euros there, to support a particularly useful politician or to bankroll some, you know, influencer who otherwise would actually have to get a real job or something. That's fair enough. These are small sums that can easily be gathered. But on a national level, they're very little. In many ways, so much more effective, I would say, are intangible means, such as, moving on to the eye, of ideology. Now look, there is no, in my opinion, real ideology to Putinism. Certainly not a single coherent one. I mean, one could almost say that there are many Putinisms which have changed over time. Remember, you know, what Putin is saying and advocating now has its roots in what he was saying in 2000 and 2005 and even 2010. But nonetheless, clearly has evolved, definitely. But also, there are different messages put out to different kind of constituencies and audiences. But what might look like a weakness is, I would suggest, in many ways a strength, precisely because this is a de-ideological regime. Yes, it believes in a certain kind of loamy, vicious, zero-sum patriotism, nationalism. But nonetheless, this is not something that really kind of transmits beyond your national borders. This is not like the Soviet Union, which did, however imperfectly and however cynically, hold to Marxism-Leninism, which did kind of constrain how it spoke outside its own borders. It had to at least pretend to fit within that particular ideological schema. Well, Russia, today's Russia, is not in any way limited. And in particular, it really, I would suggest, has emerged as the intellectual haven for the contrarian. Because if we look at what sort of people have a tendency to give Russia more credit than it's due and be more willing to listen to its particular talking points. Well, the interesting thing is there are ultra-leftists who, for some strange reason, still regard Russia as being an inheritor of the Soviet Union's place in their particular political cosmology, despite the fact that today's Russia is in many ways a neoliberal paradise, with the trade unions muzzled and controlled, and big money and big business to a large extent definitely in the driving seat. But still, there is a certain sort of sentimental leftist. There is also, though, a certain kind of right-winger who, horrified at the wokeness of the modern Western world, turns to Russia because he or she believes that it somehow epitomises the social conservatism, the traditional values and so forth that feel have been swept away at home. So leftists and rightists, but more than that, it tends to be the antis. Sheer contrarians who just basically want to feel that they're against the mainstream and naturally, willfully mistrust whatever is being said by their state media and their state politicians and so forth. Or people who are, for example, anti-American and therefore think, well, anyone who is bucking the global hegemonic trend pushed by Washington, well, they have to have something going for them. And this last one, I think, really has proven particularly effective outside of Western mainstream countries. I mean, if one looks at the global south, it really doesn't work that well as a term, but we don't really have a better term for the non-Western countries. It's interesting that Russia specifically woos them as the so-called world majority, and I'll come on to that later. But beyond that, there is a degree to which actually we in the West did not properly think through how so many of our actions, particularly relating to sanctions, would have an impact on the rest of the world. This is something I've hammered on about previous times. You know, the degree to which economic sanctions are genuinely seen by many as financial imperialism and so forth. So in this respect, actually the Russians, in their own cynical and opportunist way, have been quite effective in, horrific though it is, claiming that their war in Ukraine is an anti-imperial war. I mean, it is shocking and horrifying. considering how far this clearly is an imperial war. But nonetheless, they say, ah, well, you see, Ukraine was just simply becoming a cat's paw, a pawn of the hegemonic and imperialistic West. They were trying to use Ukraine to force Russia to bend the knee. We would not do so. We pushed back, and therefore we actually regard ourselves as an anti-imperial power. It's absolute nonsense, but nonetheless, it has a certain appeal in those countries for whom the experience of empire has been at the hands of pith-helmeted and khaki-shorted Brits, French, Belgians, Germans, Italians, whoever. So, you know, in that respect, again, they've been able to manufacture what, again, I call it, it's not really ideology, but shall we say sort of ideologically or sort of based narratives. And if you look at the way, for example, that they have cultivated the expanding BRICS universe, BRICS after all, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, part of that, beyond just simply the natural self-interest of economic interconnection and the like, but part of that is precisely saying there is another world. There is a potential world order which is separate from that of the West, and there is something of value in that. The age of Western hegemony is coming to an end, and we are the new inheritors of the world. And again, this all kind of ties into this general sense of, for the Russians, trying to create some kind of rationale. In some cases, it's just simply they can sweep up all kinds of contrarians and recruit them to their cause, or at least try and woo them to their cause. But in other cases, it's in some ways, it's giving countries or individuals an excuse. They may want, for pragmatic reasons, whether it's envelopes full of cash or something else, to actually align themselves with the Russians. What the ideology does is gives them that excuse. Rather than thinking of themselves, I am simply a loathsome and corrupt cynic, they can think of themselves as, well, yes, I'm accepting this money for my campaign, of course, but the point is, it is because there is some reason for it. So in some ways, ideology can turbocharge money. What about compromise, though? Well, look, the classic model of compromise is, you know, that the honey trap, the ha-ha, look at these photos we have of you. Though, to be perfectly honest, these days, certainly based on what's happening in British politics, you really don't need to run any kind of complex operation to get compromising materials. It seems that so many politicians are eager to send them out left, right and centre. And in some ways, that kind of compromise, I would suggest, is the least effective in these kind of circumstances. Sure, some individuals, you may be in a position to blackmail them into doing the right thing, but remember, if you blackmail people, you are basically making you their enemy, and they will do the least they can get away with, and if they are faced with some way of getting out from that blackmail, they will take it. I mean, the competent human intelligence case officer, if we go back to the espionage roots of this particular acronym, but you know, a good human intelligence case officer essentially wants to make friends with the very people he or she is going to try and turn into assets and make them betray their country and do things that may well put them in extremely harm's way. There is a certain well-targeted patriotic sociopathy involved in the process. But again, exactly, ideally you want people to be enthusiastically supporting you, not grudgingly doing so. So when it comes to you thinking of it in these terms of influence, I would suggest that the way that compromise really makes its greatest impact is particularly in terms of those individual factions, but above all countries, that in some ways are now committed to a position. So in other words, they may well want to step away from Russia, but for various reasons they will find it difficult. And look, to a degree, we actually do have this within the commentariat and the academic community. People who, and of course I'm not going to name any names, but you know, people who have already made staked out positions, which may well be controversial, may well be actually hard to sustain, or increasingly hard to sustain. But the point is that they feel that they would lose all credibility if they actually say, you know, come to think of it, that article I wrote, those points I made, nah, it's all rubbish, really. No, so instead they feel that they have to double down. We also see this to a degree with certain politicians and the like. But again, I would say it particularly happens on a regime level. And in some cases, it's because they're compromised because they have just become dependent. I mean, it's an interesting thing, for example, if you in the past bought a lot of Russian weapon systems because it was cheap and it was good enough. This has always been the sort of the Russian strength. It's not the best, but it's good enough. Anyway, you bought those. That actually locks you in to a degree. You still are going to need spares and training and maintenance and all the rest. You know, we've seen this with India, which is actually trying to move away from relying so heavily on Russian-made kit. But nonetheless, even with India's resources, they can't just simply say, OK, we are going to mothball everything Russian and just immediately buy a combination of other countries' kit. It's a slow, difficult process. So actually, you may well find that decisions that were made by previous administrations still actually lock you into certain decisions now. And, I mean, beyond that, Russian energy is a classic case in point. You know, if you get hooked on cheap Russian energy, it's hard to move away. Europe essentially has, to a considerable, but not entire extent, moved away from Russian energy. But that's because, let's be blunt, Europe, by global standards, is very rich. And even so, it's cost us a lot of money. I mean, a certain amount of money that actually ended up being paid to the United States for their expensive liquid natural gas, but let's not talk about that. But the point is, that was in some ways a strategic luxury, shall we say, that Europe could afford. Many countries cannot. So there is the compromise that is that you just have become fairly dependent, and therefore becomes very hard to actually move out of Russia's connectivity orbit. But there is also compromise in that sense of politically when you feel you have no way back. Take Lukashenko in Belarus. Every now and then there are still suggestions that he might like to essentially get himself out from under Putin's thumb, possibly by rebuilding bridges with the West through, if he's able to, broker some kind of peace in Ukraine. I'm not sure that is more than just a sort of a fanciful rumour. A, I don't think he could do it, and B, I see no signs that he is trying to do it. But the point is, I'm not even convinced that that would be enough to get Lukashenko off the hook. Syria, another case in point. Is there anything that Bashar Assad could do to avoid a prison cell in The Hague if he actually decided to disconnect himself from Russian and indeed Iranian backing? And instead tried to kind of rebuild his relationships with the West. You know, the West can be monstrously cynical many a time, but I think there are still some limits. So there are certain countries that are just compromised, so simply because either they did terrible things because the Russians demanded it, or more often they did terrible things for their own domestic reasons, and the Russians shielded them politically, militarily, or however, and now they continue to need that shield of Russian protection. So yes, there are countries that are compromised, that are basically, we can more or less write them off. And finally, ego, which I can't help but think must surely be the most powerful way to actually recruit, whether it's intelligence assets or whether it's mouthpieces and allies for your information operations. Individuals, for example, I mean, the degree to which they can be cultivated and flattered really should not be underestimated. I mean, this was a part of the whole Valdai process, you know, whereby a whole variety of Western experts, never me, he grumped. Anyway, a whole variety of Western experts were sort of summoned and brought and fated at this event, which would always have as its showcase event, you know, a chance to hear from Vladimir Putin himself. You know, generally the ways in which that they try to say, we think your particular voice is important. So I think that's been actually a very powerful way of recruiting people. And sometimes, look, it's pretty obvious a process. And the classic example would, of course, be Donald Trump, whom the Russians very much sought to cultivate by making it seem that they thought that he was this courageous figure, insightful figure, the kind of ingenious entrepreneur around whom the financial world bends. You know, all of these things that played precisely to what
Trump himself thought of himself and wanted others to think. So again, although as I said in past episodes, I don't think we should assume that Trump is some kind of bought and paid for Russian asset, let alone that if he's elected as president again, he will simply do whatever Putin wants because it's what Putin wants. But nonetheless, you know, we can see there is clearly an otherwise inconceivable degree of apparent affinity. You know, Trump is willing to give the Russians vastly more credit than, frankly, they have found other ways of earning. So, you know, that's at one level. And then, you know, one can bring it down to all kinds of other figures. And it's not just simply the state that does it directly. I mean, here is a very sort of particular case in the UK. George Galloway, the new MP for Rochdale, who, again, on the one hand, he absolutely had a very sort of anti-American hegemony stance for a long time, Iraq war and the like. When he fell foul of sort of mainstream opposition politics, he went into sort of more extreme forms of it. And in due course, he had a show on RT, the Russian state, basically foreign propaganda TV station. Now, I have no idea how far it was simply because he had things he wanted to say and RT just happened to give him a useful platform. How far he was deeply flattered by the fact that RT wooed him, whether it was that it was lucrative or whether just simply it was something that he felt gave him that necessary platform. In other words, money or ego or what? I have no idea. And again, I mean, I think probably from his point of view, it may well also have been an entirely genuine thing in the sense of exactly he thought, well, at least this channel will give me the platform that I'm not getting from the BBC and whatever else. But there's no way of getting around the fact that he, like so many other figures, will also have been deeply flattered by the fact that precisely the Russian state or elements of the Russian state wanted him. They wanted to showcase and platform him, not someone else. So, yes, you know, we really shouldn't underestimate the power of ego on an individual level. But in some ways, this also applies on a state level. I mean, again, going back to what I think is a very clever Russian tactic of using this term world majority rather than global south. I mean, people criticize global south, A, because it's technically inaccurate, but also because, again, it just sort of somehow implies that sort of the bottom half of the world, sort of disparaging connotations, whereas the Russians have spun this to world majority. In other words, you know, these are, well, putting aside the fact that one could call this therefore the world Bolsheviks, but anyway, but sort of precisely it's a positive spin, and it works, and you see this a lot. I mean, the Russians are actually pretty good, just as they are can be so vicious and bilious, and I think counterproductively so, in how they address the West. That actually they can be very good at precisely how they spin their rhetoric to non-Western countries and particularly deploy the flattery of pageantry. That when leaders from, shall I say, smaller and poorer countries, but nonetheless they come to Russia and they're greeted with all sorts of fine pomp. And Lavrov, when he travels the world and he definitely puts in his air miles, you know, again, you know, he makes a big effort of flattering these countries. Not necessarily emptily, but nonetheless in a way that actually you wouldn't necessarily get from the West. And in this respect, again, it is playing to national egos. That Russia thinks you're important. I mean, those other guys, they don't seem to think much of you, but we think you are a country on the up. We think you're a country which has something to say, and we're here to listen to you. The Russians are very good at that, and I think we avoid noticing that at our peril. And I know that in many cases there are Western diplomats in various non-Western countries who are busy sending back messages and telegrams to their head offices saying this is an issue. But the point is, in an age of cluttered attention, it's very hard to actually get politicians or indeed senior figures within foreign ministries to pay too much attention and realise that there is perhaps the need for some kind of a fight back against this. Which leads me to the sort of the last bit of this segment, which is precisely, okay, having sort of run through, you know, different ways in which I think the Russians are able to assemble for themselves some kind of basis for being heard out, what can we in the West do about it? And the first one is obviously it's about enforcement. Things like we could do with a lot more about, you know, rules on dark campaign financing, for example, to make sure that money coming indirectly from Russia does not end up supporting particularly divisive populist political movements and individuals and the like. We can do a lot more about sort of tracking bribes and so forth, and looking at the kind of what you might think of as soft bribery. I mean, yes, there is the envelope of undeclared cash slid under a toilet door at one extreme, but then there are all kinds of other sort of less obvious ones that, let's say, a company that is affiliated with the Russians provides some kind of research assistant or whatever. You know, things like that are ways in which you can, given that politicians for some strange reason want to be re-elected, you can actually provide them with support and in effect money, but not do so directly. So again, I think, you know, we need to be looking much more carefully at enforcement within our own boundaries. Outside our own boundaries, well, I think we at least have to have a sort of debate as to whether or not we would ever try and outbid the Russians. And for example, again, coming back to sanctions, I mean, often actually sanctions are essentially demanding that countries absorb costs, whether in terms of, for example, no longer being able to re-export microchips to Russia, or not be able to buy cheap Russian energy, or whatever else. But anyway, they absorb costs because we say so and because we think it's right. Now look, many of these countries also think that there is a moral case for sanctions on Russia as a result of Ukraine, but many don't really see it as such a big deal. Let's be honest about that. So from their point of view, it's a very pragmatic question. At present, they may well conform with sanctions simply because of the stick that the West, and above all that means the United States, is holding over them. But on the other hand, is that really the way we want to actually be able to win our support base? I mean, you know, we have to think about, are there ways in which either we can make sanctions and things a little bit more smart, or more to the point, if we're expecting people to take costs, is there anything we can do to help defray that cost? Not because we can actually just simply provide the money full stop, but at least we can show an awareness of what we are expecting people to give up. And that leads to my third point, which is precisely we have failed. I think it's easy to put it though so starkly. We have failed up to now properly to sell this war to the rest of the world. Why should they care? It's all very well to make kind of broad appeals to the importance of international law and so forth, but let's be absolutely blunt. In so many other situations, we in the West have been pretty lukewarm in actually going out of our way to apply international law when it was things that didn't matter to us directly, and we are now paying the price for that. Our own hypocrisies will catch us up in due course. So, yes, let's by all means try and think of how we can actually sell this current campaign, not as a we need to beat Russia, but Ukraine needs to be protected. Why actually a slow slide into a world where might makes right is not necessarily good for most countries in the world. That kind of thing. And here again, we can apply the whole mice principle. Sometimes, yes, it's going to mean directed aid. We're expecting you to give up this oil and pay more for, I don't know, this particular product. Then maybe we can try and help you out with some kind of customs deal or similar. Maybe it's ideology. Perhaps it is exactly that we can actually appeal to the things that matter to the individual countries and say, this is why, actually, this is a campaign that fits with your values. Compromise. I mean, yes, I'm not saying we should be bribing politicians to listen to us more carefully. But certainly there is a degree to which actually we also want to kind of lock people into our own community and ego. Yes, sometimes we just need to put in a bit more effort. We have too often, frankly, just simply assumed that we are right. And therefore, people who disagree with us are fools, renegades, charlatans, or indeed willing or unwitting puppets of the Kremlin. I mean, I find this so much on social media, which is a very kind of micro-scale example, which is actually, you know, step outside the mainstream And, you know, you will get a certain number of people who sort of leaping on there, more or less saying, you know, why are you... Well, in my case, there was a particular point where I suggested that curated clips from Russian TV do not necessarily give you the full picture as to what Russians are thinking, let alone what the Kremlin is thinking. And I then found myself being accused of whitewashing genocide. Thank you so much indeed. No one, I think, has ever had their opinion changed by being told that they are a bad human being. Sometimes you actually need to try and work with them and give them reasons to actually think that you care and you want to convince them rather than to browbeat them. And so all of these, I think, are worth applying. It is a big, big issue. And yes, it's not as immediate as finding enough 155mm artillery rounds for the Ukrainians or whatever else. But assuming that this is not going to be over quickly, and sadly I think we have to, well, then we actually need to be thinking about, you know, in a sharper way, about precisely how we actually approach this whole question of undermining the Kremlin's apparent capacity to find people who are willing to listen and believe its talking points, because that has a real political impact. Or maybe it's just simply that I'm bent out of shape by the fact that I've been studying Russia, particularly security forces and all these other sorts of things, for decades. And not once has some mysterious blonde turned up in a hotel bedroom. Not once has someone offered me Moscow gold. You know, it's almost as if Putin doesn't care. Actually, thinking about it, there was one kind of incident which I did wonder if that was an outreach. But anyway, that's an example for another time. Anyway, having now pontificated about sort of precisely how I felt that question sent my mind working, let's take a break. And then let me look at another one of the figures that are sometimes raised as a potential sort of rising star within Putin's Russia.
Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode.
Welcome back. Before I get started, just a little public service announcement to my patrons. I've had a few of you getting in touch. Apparently, I don't know if it's PayPal or the Patreon platform acting up again, but a certain number of you have found yourselves sort of basically being bounced out of patronage that without it actually telling you, it's decided that you've given up your subscription. I mean, if you have actually chosen not to continue being a patron, I fully accept. I'm sorry to see you go. But just in case, if you find that you're not getting the sort of patron-only messages and such like, you might want to double-check that, particularly because we're coming up to, there'll be another patrons Q&A, which I'll be putting out a call for questions shortly. Anyway, so who am I looking at today? Today I'm looking at, again, not necessarily a name on everyone's lips, Yuri Trutnev. Yuri Petrovich Trutnev, who's the Deputy Prime Minister and also the Presidential Plenipotentiary Representative, was a bit of a mouthful that, to the Far Eastern Federal District, and has been since 2013. And, you know, he's sometimes raised as a potential future president, though I'm not necessarily convinced about that one. But on the other hand, at least as one of the potential figures who are kind of on the bench for example, prime ministerial or similar kind of positions. So given that we are on the verge of a potential, though I'm not anticipating it, reshuffle of the government, I thought it was worth just digging in a little bit, because it also says something about, I think, how a fairly savvy politician, not necessarily one of the absolute A-star list, but nonetheless positions himself in these particular times. So, I said, Yuri Petrovich Trutnev, who was born in 1956, graduated from the mining department of the Perm Polytechnic Institute with a degree as a mining engineer specialising in oil and gas, went and became a junior researcher at the Perm Research and Design Institute of the Oil Industry. I'm sure it's not actually pronounced Perm-Nipi-Neft, but that just simply it sounds quite funny to say it that way. But look, it was clear that he was on a political track early on. I mean, at the same time as he was building his career within the oil industry, he was also an active member of the Komsomol, the Young Communist League. Remember, this is still Soviet times. Became an instructor on the Perm City Committee of Komsomol. And in 1986 to 88, he headed the Committee on Sports Affairs of the Perm Regional Executive Committee. Sport? Does this mean he's part of the judocracy? Not quite, but maybe, shall we say, a kissing cousin. Not judo, but karate. And more on that later. Anyway, by this point, it's the late 1980s, and Gorbachev's Soviet Union is opening for business. And very quickly, in 1988, Trutnev, together with his partners, creates a cooperative. Remember, cooperatives were the structure that was allowed to generate some kind of small business as part of sort of trying to make the Soviet Union more of a hybrid economy. So the state controlled still the commanding heights, but just as during Lenin's new economic policy era, there were these cooperatives, which are the sort of the structures which actually allowed for people to do everything from set up little import-export firms to restaurants to whatever else. Anyway, they created this cooperative called Contact, which is involved in the production and the development of sports simulators. And these were sold mainly, it has to be said, to various government organisations. So in other words, Trutnev and Co. were making money off government connections. The boy learned the bases of capitalism with Russian characteristics pretty fast. In 1990, this became X Limited, EKS, a company which he ran, and yet at the same time he remained in politics. In 1994, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, he was elected to the Legislative Assembly in the Perm region, and indeed the Perm City Duma. And when he was in the Legislative Assembly, he headed the Committee on Economic Policy and Taxes, which must have come in handy in those wild and woolly days. Politics ran side by side with business. In 1996, he became president of EKSX International, had now become a joint stock company, which he ran. And that same year, he was elected mayor of Perm. Politics certainly didn't get in the way of business, because at the same time, EKS International, X International, was actually expanding its range. It still was doing exercise equipment and the like, but on the other hand, it was also doing everything from arranging tours of strongmen, teams of athletes going around showing their thing, selling imported cars, and even actually importing and distributing Nestle chocolate. Why Nestle chocolate? Well, I mean, on the one hand, obviously the answer to any question relating to chocolate should always be yes. But more specifically, it's because he had a connection with Oleg Chirkunov, who at that point was working at the trade mission, the Russian Federation trade mission in Switzerland. So again, this is a case of personal contacts, political contacts actually, being parlayed into economic gain. And when Chirkunov returned to Perm, the two of them actually sort of set up and jointly owned a chain of supermarkets. So he had built up a significant local political and economic stake. And in December 2000, on the eve of the Putin era, he mobilized this to be elected governor of the Perm region, defeating the incumbent Gennady Yugumnov in the first round with a very handy 51% of the vote. And in a micro-scale example, I would say, of the wider political dynamics taking place in Russia at the time, Trutnev won not least because he was heavily supported by the local business community. He had wooed them, and all of a sudden we found local newspapers and everything else all saying that Trutnev was the best thing since, well, Nestle chocolate. In his capacity as governor of a region, that meant he sat on the state council, and it seems to be there that he actually caught Putin's eye in the first case. There's no earlier connection. And then in March 2004... by decree of the President of the Russian Federation, Putin himself, he was made Minister of Natural Resources in the government of Mikhail Fradkov. Remember him? Yeah. No, exactly. Another one of the Prime Ministers who came and went, though in some ways he became more known actually as in his role as an intelligence chief. Anyway, so 2004, Minister of Natural Resources, and he held that lucrative job. I say lucrative because actually a lot of the ministerial job involves obviously distributing contracts and being involved in a lot of the kind of high-level deals which tend to carry with them, shall we say, payments to expedite them, shall we say. Anyway, so he held that lucrative job through to 2012, at which point he briefly became assistant to the president for supervision of the State Council. So in other words, he was basically Putin's eyes and ears on the State Council, which, put it another way, meant that he was really Putin's main advisor on regional relations and regional issues. And I'm sure it's just the coincidence that in 2012, just as in 2009, he had the highest personal income of any official in government, which is a pretty impressive record to have made. But didn't hold that for long, because next year he became Deputy Prime Minister and Presidential Plenipotentiary to the Far Eastern District, two positions he's held since. It's worth dwelling for a moment, what is a Presidential Plenipotentiary? Because after all, there are governors. Governors basically run these territorial regions for the President. So why do you need someone over a sort of these larger federal districts that obviously comprise multiple districts and regions? Well, in some ways the plenipotentiary is a kind of super governor, but I would say more, shall we say, a governor supervisor. He should not and is not involved in managing detail. Instead is the curator, the overseer, who tries to take a look at the wider federal district in itself, but also in particular is there to monitor the governors and, if need be, step in if they happen to be going out of line. However, it's worth noting that not every such plenipotentiary representative is a deputy prime minister. That's actually something specific for Trutnev, and I think it ties in with the fact that it is actually the Far East that is his pitch. Sure, we now are in an age of instant communications, but nonetheless, the Far East is more distant from Moscow, not just in physical terms, but also in political terms. There is the fact that actually, you know, it borders onto China, and more to the point, it borders onto the Chinese economy, which definitely gives it a certain distinct characteristic of its own. More on that in a moment. And it also, I think, has, you know, a more complex, I think, array of practical tasks, which often do require a lot more coordination between regions. So I think in this respect, you know, actually being plenipotentiary representative to the Far Eastern Federal District is something that is actually quite a specific challenge. And since December, I think it was, 2018, he's also been chair of the State Commission for Arctic Development. So it's interesting, he's got the Far East, and to a degree, he's also got the Arctic. So he has this sort of crescent of responsibilities. That's all very well, but these are different times. What have you done for the war, Yuri Petrovich? Well, in December of 2022, he was one of the two people who were responsible for setting up the Soyuz Volunteer Battalion, which is created on the basis of the Russian Union of Martial Arts, to raise soldiers from athletes. And in fact, some of them actually really quite sort of significant. There was Victor Gorn, who was a karate World Cup champion. There was Sergei Plakhanov, a famous kickboxer. Sergei Uvitsky, who was another karate champion who actually has been killed in action. Anyway, so this sort of Soyuz unit went in to fight. At a time, and this is again December 2022, this was still in the time when, frankly, the military were desperate for forces, and all kinds of different individuals and institutions were being encouraged to do what they could to build them up. And in fact, organizations like Sberbank helped provide the funding for Soyuz. Who was the other guy who was responsible for setting it up? Sergei Kirienko, first deputy head of the presidential administration. Kirienko? Yeah, because they're both really into karate. So maybe, perhaps, if the judocracy of Putin will eventually go, perhaps we can actually see a new karatocracy. Who knows? The point is that ever since the founding of the Russian Union of Martial Arts in 2005, Trutnev has been a co-chair, and so too have Kirienko. This is one of the things I think people don't fully appreciate, the degree to which actually Trutnev is very close to Kiryenko. It's not just that they both like karate, it's actually that they also socialise and they serve on a whole body of sports-related committees together. Who else is a co-chair, though, of this Union of Martial Arts? Well, there's Daniil Martinov, who is an aide to Chechnya's Ramzan Kadyrov and head of the Russian Special Forces University in Chechnya, where, in fact, Soyuz trained. And who else? Well, Soyuz itself is commanded by Ramil Gabasov, who is another co-chair of the Union of Martial Arts and also its executive director. So you have an interesting little kind of collection of people united by this interest in martial arts who have now made a very kind of public and demonstrative act by creating Soyuz, which is still in the field, it has to be said. And also through that, they demonstrate their loyalty, but also some have suggested have found ways to also enrich themselves. I'm sure that's a terribly cynical point of view. But nonetheless, the Trutnevs are clearly trying to make their support for the war known. And I say Trutnevs because his son and daughter, Andrei and Maria Trutnev, according to an investigation by this project, the T-invariant project, so it's not been confirmed, but nonetheless, apparently, even while trying to kind of hide their identity, were founders of the Student Patriotic Association at Moscow State University, which collects money for fighters at the front. So it's good to know that the family is doing its bit. And I say family, I mean Trutnev is married with another two sons and a daughter, and his eldest son, Dmitry, is on the board of directors of the Central Cooperative Bank, but I'm sure that's well earned for a 32-year-old financial advisor. And the Trutnevs enjoy the usual standard of living for a senior Russian official. According to an investigation by Alexei Navalny, which was published back in 2020, he owns a mansion in Serebryany Bor worth 2 billion rubles. Now, Serebryany Bor, literally silver pine wood, it's at this lovely forest park in northwest Moscow, and not coincidentally much favoured by rich business people and officials. So that's his trajectory. But what's he doing at the moment, and what can that maybe tell us about where he might see his future going? Well, he certainly has stepped up his public game really quite substantially in the past year. And looking at it, I would say that there are kind of three main angles, three kinds of, shall I say, three Trutnevs that he's trying to push. There is Trutnev, the competent super manager. Whether it's encouraging local governments in the Far East to find investments for new roads in Primorye region, or whether it's calling for a clarification of regulations to ensure safe mining operations after a recent accident, he very much is doing the local politics bit, even if his local is essentially a sort of continent-sized chunk of Russia. But again, that sense of Trutnev is on top of whatever's going on. He's the guy who basically provides that, not just the strategic guidance, but even quite micro-scale stuff. So that's definitely the idea that Trutnev is your man. And that's quite sort of Sobyanin-Mishustin-y. I don't think he does it quite as well, but I would say he's very much looking to them as his model. The second particular form is Trutnev the China hand. Again, he's really trying to emphasise the fact that his role as plenipotentiary to the Far East has meant a lot of constant engagement. A lot of constant engagement. Sorry about that rather ugly phrasing. Anyway, it has meant considerable engagement with China on border issues, but above all on economic issues. In December, for example, he co-hosted the Intergovernmental Commission for Cooperation of Northeastern China and the Far Eastern Baikal region of Russia. That's a snappy title for you. With Chinese Vice Premier Zhang Guoqing, I probably mispronounced that. And again, that got a lot of attention locally. The idea that, you know, Trutnev, he's the one who knows how to handle the Chinese, which again, clearly matters now and will continue to matter, or indeed will be becoming more important in the near future. And thirdly, we of course have Trutnev the Patriot. It's not just Soyuz. I mean, in February, for example, he used a meeting of the so-called Government Commission on the Protection of Russian Presence in Spitsbergen to demonstrate that he was a tough nationalist of the new school, claiming, for example, that Russian rights to this in this Norwegian archipelago, and let's just underline that, Norwegian archipelago, were under pressure, and he even drew a very, very dubious parallel with the special military operation when he said, "I think we should address the work here in government the same way that the work here is also a fight for our sovereignty, a fight for the rights of Russia and Russians, because none of the rights and benefits acquired by Russia can be reduced or infringed. We do not have the right to move even a single step backwards." Not one step back. But then, perhaps more specifically, in April, he actually went to the Donbass. Again, this is part of the cursus honorum, frankly, of Russian officials these days. They have to be sort of seen there. And while he was there, he made a point of handing over clothing, weapons and kit, not just to Soyuz, but also to a local unit called Cascade, and saying, "This support will continue until our victory." He's doing a lot to try and encourage the reorientation of industries in the Far East to defence production. And it's worth noting that Khabarovsk region is also the official sponsor of the ruined small city of Debaltseve. And again, a lot of this is getting, you know, quite a bit of coverage. So he's trying to make the point that Trutnev is not standing by when the motherland is in a time of need. The big question is, of course, is this just the necessary activities of a politician in these times of political uncertainty to preserve his position? Or is it something more? Is he looking further? This is the interesting point, though. I don't see him as a likely prime minister. I mean, it's possible. It's by no means impossible. But given that I don't think Mishustin, there's any great need to remove him at the moment, why would you put in someone who is a little bit more political, but essentially in so many ways a Mishustin alike? However, there is the suggestion that Kirienko, who does seem to have higher ambitions, may well be looking now to move from the presidential administration into the government, perhaps to as a sort of deputy prime minister's role, with a thought to an eventual step upwards. Now, if Kirienko does that, who takes over his position as essentially head of the domestic political management block within the presidential administration? Kirienko will want someone he knows, someone whom he thinks is loyal, someone whom he thinks is capable of operating at both local and national levels. I wonder who Kirienko might be thinking. Just saying. Anyway, thanks very much. That's my look at Trutnev, who's, as I said, it was interesting when I was looking at him and sort of digging more deeply, because obviously I've been aware of him for a long time, but hadn't necessarily sort of really focused on him. A strangely frictionless person. We know what he does, we know what he says, and one can draw all kinds of inferences. But I still feel that there's something more about Trutnev that I haven't got my finger on yet. If anyone else has had an interesting interaction with him, or know something particularly sort of deep and meaningful about him, by all means let me know. But in the meantime, thank you as ever for listening. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/inmoscowshadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.